chapter 7, we're going to be talking about Melchizedek. And I told you last week, the title of this particular part is Melchizedek, Pontifex Maximus. What does that mean? It basically is Latin for high priest. Okay? Maximus means high. Okay. Pontifex is Latin for priest. High priest in Latin really refers to the idea of a bridge builder. That's really what it means. And so the idea of the high priest is really a bridge builder between God and man. So that high priest, and you go back and you look at the old law and the role of the high priest the law of Moses was that one who was the intercessor, so to speak, or the go-between between God and the Israelite people. In other words, the only person under the law of Moses, the only person who was allowed into the Holy of Holies was the high priest. And he went in to make intercession for the sins of the people and so forth. There's a lot of imagery. There's a lot of things that the Israelite people understood in a sense that God was here and they were here and they weren't allowed to approach God, not directly. And when you go to Mount Sinai, the giving of the law, what was the command that God gave to Moses in terms of the people approaching the mountain? Yeah, they weren't allowed to, and if they approached the mountain, they touched the mountain, they would die. You see? And so they had this concept and this idea that, there's a big separation between themselves and God, and the high priest was the one that filled that gap, and not just filled the gap, but made a bridge between them and God. And so the high priest in Israelite understanding and belief and practice and so forth, the high priest was a vitally important part of their relationship with God and their practices and so forth. So let's keep that in mind, and let's get somebody, if you would, to read chapter 6, verse 20, and down through chapter 7, verse 10. Anybody got that one to read? Don't be shy. Go ahead, Peggy.
It ends in the inner sanctuary of the high priest, where Jesus, who went before us, has entered in on behalf, on our behalf. He has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek was king of Salem and priest of God most high. He met Abraham returning from the defeat of the kings and blessed him. And Abraham gave him the hint of everything. First, his name means king of righteousness. And also, king of Salem means king of peace. Without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning or days of the end of life, by the Son of God, he remained in peace forever. Just think how great he was. Even patriarch Abraham gave him a tenth of the plunder. Now the law requires the descendants of Levi who become priests to collect a tenth from the people. That is, their brothers, even though their brothers are descended from Abraham. This man, however, did not trace the descendant of Levi, yet he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. And without doubt, the lesser person is blessed by the greater. And in one case, the tenth is collected by him who died, but in the other case, by him who was declared to be living. One might even say that Levi, who collects the tenth, paid the tenth through Abraham. Because then, in Israel, met Abraham, Levi was still in the body of his ancestor.
Okay. So, question as we start out this morning is, who is this guy, Melchizedek? All right? There are really only two other passages in the Bible, the entire Bible, about Melchizedek outside of what the writer of Hebrews has to say about him. Okay? Those two verses are very short. Okay? Genesis chapter 14 and verse 18 is the text that the writer here refers to when Abraham came back from rescuing his nephew Lot and his people and all. Then Melchizedek met him on the way, and Abraham paid him a tenth of all the spoils that they got from getting Lot and his people back. And Melchizedek blessed him on that occasion. Psalm 110 in verse 4. Somebody turn there and read that for us, please. Psalm 110 and verse 4. That is the other place in the whole Bible that Melchizedek is mentioned. Verse 4. Okay. Now, if you go through and you look at this psalm in its entirety, it's a psalm that really is focusing on the Davidic kingdom. In other words, it's a psalm that draws on the Messiah, who is said to be going to sit on the throne of David. But the mention here is that he will be what? He'll be a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So we have these two places in the whole rest of the Bible where Melchizedek is mentioned. So until you get to the book of Hebrews, Melchizedek is pretty much of a mystery. Okay? Who is this guy? Well, he's described as a high priest of God. Right? When you look at Psalm 110 and verse 4, this Davidic king, the Messiah that is going to come, right, is going to be like Melchizedek. That's part of his point. And there are two major aspects of Melchizedek that need to be pointed out. Melchizedek was what kind of a high priest? He was both a priest and a king. Okay? That's significant, okay, because this psalm is really all about the final king, that is the Messiah, and showing him, that coming king, the Messiah, to be in the same order as that of Melchizedek. So the Hebrew writer then uses this particular verse in Psalm 110 to show why Jesus, the reigning heir of David, is the ultimate priest. Now again, keep in mind the definition of the word priest. What is that? What does the word priest mean? A bridge builder. Okay? A bridge builder. So the writer here is wanting his audience, again, these early Christian Hebrews or Hebrew Christians, to understand and to recognize Jesus as the ultimate bridge builder between them and God. Right? Now that Jesus has arrived, Christian Jews are not to return to the ordinary Judaism in order to escape persecution. And that's part of the problem that we've been addressing through this study, that you know the writer is trying to revive this group of Christians who in a lot of ways are kind of in thinking, well, you know, we were better off under the old law. If you go back from where they were at that point to the old law, what do you have in terms of a priesthood? Yeah, you've got the Levites, you've got, you know, the high priest under, you know, the order of Aaron and so forth, which is just simply another human being, right? Nothing really special about them other than that they are of the house of Levi. This high priest that he's trying to focus their attention on, that is Jesus, is of a whole different order than of the order of Aaron. Okay? Far, far superior to the order of Aaron. If they, in other words, are kind of thinking that they'd be able to escape persecution as Christians and still be able to please God by going back to the regulations of the law and living under the old law and the old priesthood, it will not work. And they needed to understand that. So that brings us then to what the writer of Hebrews has to say about this Melchizedek. And again, we get most of the information we have about Melchizedek from the writer of Hebrews, not from the Old Testament at all, which is the time that he actually lived. But the writer of Hebrews gives us a tremendous amount of insight into this man, Melchizedek. But why the focus on Melchizedek? In other words, you know, again, throughout all of the Old Testament, all of the prophets, you know, you have these two passages, Genesis and one in Psalm, that even mentions Melchizedek at all. The writer of Hebrews spends a lot of time focusing on Melchizedek. Okay? Though the problem is that these tired Christians who are in danger of going back to Judaism, and that's where they were wanting to go, back under the old law, they place their hope in the law, the prophets, and the priesthood. You have to keep in mind and remember, when you lived under the law, okay, you lived under the whole thing. Okay? Remember, the Apostle Paul says, if you violate one part of the law, how much of the law do you violate? The whole thing. Okay? And so it was a package deal. And so the priesthood was a vitally important aspect and part of living under the law. Because, let me ask you, why the priesthood so important? We talked about the idea of the bridge builder, but what was the high priest's duty? What did he really do for the people that they couldn't do for themselves? Yeah. He's the one that went to God and offered the sacrifices for what? To roll their sins back. Every year on the Day of Atonement, that's one of the things that he did. Remember the whole issue, we talked about this, it's been a while, but we talked about the whole issue of the scapegoat. Remember that they were to have two goats on the Day of Atonement, and one they brought, they offered for a sacrifice. The other, the high priest, placed his hands on the head of the goat and pronounced the sins of the people, and then they sent that goat out into the wilderness away from the camp. And it was symbolical of carrying the sins of the people away from the camp so that they would be free of the sin, the penalty of the sin. That's where we get the word or the term scapegoat from. But the idea was that the high priest is the one who did that for the people. They didn't have access to just be able to do that, offer the sacrifices on their own, and so forth. Thank you. You look confused.
Well, now I understand that they didn't have any relationship with God.
Not really. Not. If you follow just the strictness of the law, which is what they were doing, okay, then it was easy to miss the element of relationship with God we wanted. But again, there was this certain distance that God kept from the people. And it wasn't, I don't think, in God's intention that they not have a relationship. God always wanted a relationship with his people, but it was more of the way that God had established that things were to be done, and I think for this purpose. So that when the time of Christ would come, they would recognize the difference. You see? So again, do you want to live under the old law where, no, you got to, everything you've got to do, you got to go through the high priest and the mediator and all this kind of stuff? Or do you want to live under Christ where you have direct access to the throne room of God? You see? So it had to be something that would be very different under Christ. And that's really what the writer's focus is to show how much superior the high priesthood of Jesus is over the high priesthood of Aaron under the law of Moses. They needed to see, that is, these Hebrew Christians, they needed to see and understand that Jesus preceded the law and the prophets and the priesthood. Okay? Jesus came even before all of those things. Again, keep in mind the mindset of the Jews at that time, the time of Jesus, the first century. The mindset of the Jews was very much, again, the law is everything, right? Okay, we follow the law. And who was it that gave us the law? Moses, okay? But we mentioned this before, there are two other people that, you know, as I talked about before, the idea of dropping names. When you drop names, you know, it's kind of like the E.F. Hutton. When they speak, people listen, right? And so you have three Old Testament figures that fit into that category. When you mention their name, people sit up and take notice. The first one is who? Abraham, because he is what? He is our father. Our father Abraham, right? Okay, then you have, as we mentioned a moment ago, Moses, who is the lawgiver. And then you have who? Not Jacob. David, who is the what? The king. You see? So you have our father Abraham, you have Moses the lawgiver, you have David the king. So mention any of those three to a Hebrew, and they're going to pay attention to what you have to say. So how does Melchizedek fit into all of this? Well, the writer points out some really, really interesting things. The message of Melchizedek is that Christianity supersedes or replaces Judaism. Okay? In other words, Christianity, they need to understand, Christianity is not just an alternative. It's not just an alternative form of worship or religion, but it is a replacement, a complete replacement of the old law and the old ways. Okay? If you go over to Colossians chapter 2, verses 13 through 15, Paul emphasizes this fact, okay, that Christianity is a replacement, not just an alternative. So look at what he says. When you were dead in your sins and in the uncircumcision of your sinful nature, God made you alive with Christ. He forgave all of our sins, having, listen to this, canceled the written code. What's the written code he's talking about here? The law. Okay? And so Paul says that he canceled that. What does it mean when you cancel something? It's no longer there. Okay? You have a debt and someone cancels that debt, it's no longer there, right? So it doesn't exist anymore. All right? He goes on to say, he canceled that written code with its regulations that was against us and stood opposed to us. He took it away, nailing it to the cross. And having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Carrie Bell said that going back to Judaism would be like exchanging a diamond for a piece of coal. And that's what they needed to understand. And so the writer here is focusing on Melchizedek to help them to understand why that is so true. So they needed to understand that there was nothing to go back to. Okay? As far as now, you say, well, wait a minute, you know, there were still Jews and there were still, you know, practicing Jews, and there even are today, right? So we mean there's nothing to go back to. Doesn't Judaism still exist? Absolutely. The problem is, for those who still follow it, is that God does not recognize it as, you say, as a, what's the word I'm looking for, the proper relationship that he wants with them. Why? Because it doesn't exist anymore as far as God is concerned. Judaism is over as far as a religious practice in God's sight. Does that make sense? Y'all understand what I'm saying here? It has been replaced. It's been taken out of the way. So those who practice Judaism in terms of religion as far as God is concerned, it's an effort in futility. Because God no longer recognizes that as a valid law or form of relationship with him. Does that mean that the law of Moses was a bad thing? And all those, you know, things under the law? No. It means that they had their purpose, and their purpose had been fulfilled at the death of Christ on the cross. And once that purpose has been fulfilled, it is no longer necessary. And it will not accomplish what it was able to accomplish when it was in existence. Okay? Everybody with me so far? I'll make sure that I don't confuse anybody on this, all right? Because again, he says it was canceled. Taken out of what? That's important even for us today to understand, because not because of Judaism itself, but because too many people today religiously are still trying to live under parts of the old law. How many times have you ever heard someone say, or maybe even said yourself, well, all you got to do is keep the Ten Commandments and you'll be okay? What about that? Is that true or not? Is that all we really need to do, just keep the Ten Commandments? Why? Well, not only that, but it doesn't exist anymore. Okay? The Ten Commandments do not apply anymore. And not only that, but when the Ten Commandments did apply, and again, keep in mind, the Ten Commandments were the foundation or basis of the law of Moses, when they did apply, who did they apply to? To the Jews. They didn't apply to anybody else. So they have never applied to us and Gentiles. Okay? They don't apply to us, to we-ins and you-ins, okay? However you want to say it, we're Gentiles. The law of Moses never applied to anyone except the Jews. So if it were still in force today, it still would not apply to us. All right? Everybody with me on that? Unless you were proselyted, and that did occur. We'll talk about that in just a moment. That did occur on occasion. Proselyting is converting someone. So there were Gentiles who were converted to Judaism, and they came under the law. Okay? But the law never applied to anybody else except the Jews when it was in force. So you take that aspect of it and you add it to the fact that it's not even enforced for Jews any longer today, right? Then we begin to understand why the writer here was talking about this, to say going back to that is futile. You're going back to something, you're trying to go back to something that doesn't even exist anymore in terms of a relationship with God. God has replaced that with something, what's the key word?
Better.
Thank you. And that's the message he's trying to get them to understand. If you go back to the old and try to live under that, you're living under something that doesn't have an effect anymore, and you're living under something that isn't anywhere near as good as what you have. And that's why, again, as Terry Bell said a moment ago, he says it's like exchanging a diamond for a piece of coal. What are you going back to? You're taking something that is tremendously valuable and you're exchanging it for something that's worth nothing. And that's what they would be doing. Okay. A lot of Christians today are tempted to go back to their old ways. It's tough trying to live a Christian life, isn't it? It's tough. And I've mentioned before, you know, there are times, you know, in my life, I look at some of the things that God tells us we're supposed to be doing, and I go, I don't like that. It'd be a whole lot easier not to have to forgive this person for what they've done. Some of the stuff that he tells us is just tough. And Satan's always right there, tempting us. Let go of it. Go back. You don't have to live under these rules anymore. Live how you want to. Be happy. All those other lies that Satan tells. And so much like the Hebrew Christians back then, many Christians today are tempted to be pulled back to their old way of life. Okay?
Russ, you and I, growing up Catholic, you wanted a relationship with God, so did I. And under that law, we couldn't get it. And then finally, when we found the bridge, Jesus Christ, and we had the bridge, I don't want to go back.
Yeah.
It is tough. It's tough. But I have something, and we all have something that we've been longing for in that relationship. Why go back and hide from God, you know, like Pain did? No, have to keep a relationship.
Absolutely.
Why go on the other side of the bank and just look at God from afar when you can go to
Him? And, you know, again, part of it is, what are you going back to? In case of the Israelites, when they came out of Egypt, out of bondage in Egypt, because they were slaves there, and you know, before they even, as we talked about before they crossed the Red Sea, they were already longing to go back, right? To what? To slavery. You are free in your free from your sins in Christ Jesus. Why long to go back to slavery? I long to go back. So, again, then this whole thing about Melchizedek and the way that the writer here is bringing him out, you know, again, what's the purpose of all of this talk about Melchizedek? Well, it's to help these, again, keep in mind the audience is a Jewish audience, right? They knew the law. They knew, you know, all the history. They knew the law and the prophets and so forth. And they understood the value of the priesthood. And what they need to understand is that, listen to this, that the order of Jesus' priesthood came before Moses and before Judaism even existed. Okay? Did you catch that? Do you understand what I'm saying here? These Hebrew Christians who were wanting to go back to the old law, needed to understand why Jesus was superior, because his priesthood existed before Moses came and gave them the law, freed them from Egyptian slavery, and before the priesthood under Moses existed, okay? Before Judaism even existed, all right? He tells us here that Jesus is a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. All right, well, what does he tell us about Melchizedek? And Melchizedek had no father or mother, no beginning, and no end. What does that mean? He just kind of poof, he was there?
Yeah.
Melchizedek didn't have a mama? No, that's not his point. There's no record of anything about Melchizedek. Again, this is all we got. Why is that significant? How important was genealogy to the Jews? You could not be a priest under the Levitical priesthood unless you came from the tribe of Levi. And you had to be able to prove your lineage. You say, it wasn't just where somebody come on and say, well, yeah, you know, hey, I want to be a priest here. You know, I like the priesthood and I'd like to do that. I feel God's calling. Let's see your credentials. Who is your father and mother? All the way back to Levi. And if you couldn't show that, you don't have that. But here it is, Melchizedek. He didn't have a genealogy to show who he was, where he came from, who his father and mother were. Okay? But yet Jesus is a priest in that order. Melchizedek was before there were Jews and Gentiles. Now think about that. Was Abraham a Jew or a Gentile? Jew? He wasn't either. The Israelite nation had not yet been established. It would be established through him. Okay? But in that day, there was no such thing as Jews and Gentiles. There were just people. You'll say, well, who is this Melchizedek in terms of relationship with God? I mean, was he a Jew or was he a Gentile? He was neither. But yet the Bible describes him as a priest of who? God Most High. Well, in what religion? God. He worshiped God. He was, in that sense, just like Abraham and most likely other people of Abraham's day, of the patriarchal period, again, before there was a Jewish nation, okay, there were those who worshiped God. Jerusalem, right.
He was king of
Jerusalem. Right. Absolutely. You understand, again, why this is so significant? Because the Jews placed so much value on their heritage and who they were, and the fact that Abraham was their father and Moses gave them the law and David was their king. And the writer here is telling them, look, let's go before any of that stuff happened. When did the Israelites become a nation? You have Abraham, and you have Isaac, and you have Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, who became the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. But when did that happen? long after Melchizedek. It happened when they were in Egypt, didn't it? When they went into Egypt, they were a family, right? They were Jacob's family. When they came out of Egypt, they were a nation of people. The Israelites. So Melchizedek and his, don't miss this part of it, Melchizedek and his priesthood existed before any of that. And the writer here is wanting them to go all the way back to Melchizedek and say, let me tell you about this Jesus, why he's so superior to what you had. His priesthood existed before Moses, before the Israelites were even a people. That's why he says in this one verse in here, he says, let me see, we find it here, verse 8 and 9. In the one case, the tent is collected by men who died, but in another case, by him who is declared to be living. One might even say that Levi, who was Levi? One of the 12 sons of Israel, right? Okay? That Levi, who collects the tent, that is, the order of the priesthood collected the tithe from the people, right? That's what he's talking about here. Paid the tenth through Abraham, because when Melchizedek met Abraham, Levi was still in the body of his ancestor. In other words, Levi hadn't even been born yet when Abraham paid his tithe to Melchizedek. And this one who you focus on as being so great, that is Abraham, your father Abraham. How did he fit into this picture? He gave tithe to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek blessed him. And what does he say here about that? Yeah. Without, verse 7, without doubt, the lesser person is blessed by the greater. Who got blessed? Abraham. Who blessed him? Melchizedek. So who's greater, Abraham or Melchizedek? Melchizedek. And Jesus is a priest in the order of Melchizedek. You see, they needed to understand. How are we doing on time? I can carry away. Okay. So his priesthood then, that is the priesthood of Jesus, is far superior than the Mosaic priesthood. Jesus is the new bridge builder. In an order of bridge builders that is far superior to the ones under the old law. Right? If a high priest was to be a bridge builder between God and man, Jesus was a bridge builder that was far superior than any high priest under the old law that they were wanting to go back to. So again, them wanting to go back there would have been trading something of tremendous value for something that was worth absolutely nothing because it did not exist any longer. That is the old law. Yeah, it was inadequate to do that. Any questions on any of that at all? Okay, yeah, G.
Well, I know we're not supposed to go back to the Ten Commandments, but in love, the Ten Commandments, I really love. I thought that was all in my heart. All of that,
And, you know, that's not saying the Ten Commandments are bad. Okay? And are they still a good code to live by? Absolutely. But are we bound to live by the Ten Commandments? And the law will know. And then again, the most important point is, if I just, as again, people oftentimes say, if all I do is try to live by the Ten Commandments, is that going to be sufficient for me to be saved? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And they're carried over. Yeah, we find the same, those same things are carried over into the New Testament in all kinds of statements that we find. Charlie?
I just want to add that if you go to the library, the board that's in the 12 tribes, because what gets up there for us all to read, I was getting ready to talk with you about changing it, but should I change it?
No, leave it up there. Leave it up there.
I'll just clean it up again.
We want that stuff up there so people can go in and look and see. But yeah, that's... Okay. All right, here's what we're going to do, because we're out of time today. We're going to, next week, we're going to talk a little bit more about this. We're going to look specifically at some ways that the priesthood under Christ is superior to the old priesthood. All right? So that's what we'll talk about next time. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.